Hello and welcome to another episode of Politics Jam, a weekly podcast dedicated to analysing the week's news and top topics through a political science lens. I'm Michael, joined as always by Jeevan. Jeev, how are you today?
I'm great today, Michael. I'm excited to talk about Brexit and I'm really glad we haven't had to talk about it until now. How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks. And I can definitely echo the sentiments.
Sure you're okay, Mike?
I'm great.
You don't want to talk about VAR or anything?
I do not want to talk about VAR today. That's the last thing on my mind at the moment. Listen, we were robbed on a weekend. That's what I'm going to say. We were robbed on a weekend.
Okay, buddy.
And we are delighted today to be joined on a podcast by a special guest, Professor Annan Menon. Now, Annan is a professor of European politics and foreign affairs at King's College London and the director of UK Interchange in Europe. Annan, how are you?
I'm good. And can I just say, this week, VAR is fantastic. Everton had two goals disallowed because of VAR, and I'm all in favour of it.
Oh, gosh.
Last week, it was rubbish.
What was the score in the end then, Annan? I didn't 1-0. Actually realise what...
1-0 to the mighty Leeds.
Wow.
You battered them as well, to be fair. You really did. Yeah, like, 24 shots.
I mean, that means nothing.
How are you finding it, Annan? Before we get started, like Leeds being back in the top flight, how have you found the first, 10 games or so?
Well, I'm quite old, so this is basically just a reassertion of normality for me. This is how it should be. Now, I understand that for those of a certain generation, that sounds weird because, like, my son, for instance, became interested in football in about 2004, which I think was just when we were going into administration. So he takes with a pinch of salt my claims that we used to be good. But for me, this is just we're back. Well, we're not quite back where we belong because we're not in the top four yet. But give it a couple of years and normal service will be resumed.
That's a bold statement.
You've got to be bold, otherwise you get depressed.
Right, so on today's...
I mean, what can I say? We're going to do well.
I think Leeds will do well too. Like, I think Marco Bielsa is a good manager. I'm intrigued by him as well. Like, the way managers speak about him, like Pep Guardiola has spoken about him being like an influence, and Pochettino too. And he's like the two of the best coaches in the world. So,
yeah.
Who knows? Leeds could be a top four team, as Annan says, next season. Who knows?
Well, it's been great talking to you both. See you later.
Right, and in today's podcast, we're joined by Annan to discuss Brexit, more specifically, the likelihood of a deal and the potential political and economic implications for the UK. Now, Annan, my understanding is that the political red lines on both sides are preventing a deal from being struck. So the EU side, the argument is that you can't do anything to weaken our market. And on the UK side, the idea is that British sovereignty is really, really important. Is this a good reading of where we're at the moment?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, we can talk about fish if we really must, because there is a fish issue as well. But I mean, you're right. I don't think the EU argument is quite we don't want to weaken our market. It is we don't want to run the risk of cheap or unfair imports from the UK flooding our market. So this is slightly different to this isn't the cherry picking argument we used to have, which is you can't have bits without others, because Boris Johnson has been quite clear. We don't want any of your market. We don't want to be in the single market. But what the EU is saying now is, even if you don't want to be in the single market, you have to sign up to some of our rules, because if we give you tariff-free access to our market and you don't sign up to our environmental standards, our worker standards and things like that, your producers will have an unfair advantage and they'll be getting stuff into our market tariff-free that we can't compete with. So, and of course, the British line, as you quite rightly say, is the whole point of Brexit was not to be under your rules. So it'd be a bit bizarre to sign up to your rules in a Brexit deal.
And just on a Brexit deal, how likely do you think a Brexit deal is from being struck? So there needs to be compromises on both sides, but how likely is that between now and the deadline?
I don't know. I mean, for this, you might as well have an astrologer as a social scientist on, because quite frankly, as far as I can see, a deal now hinges on whether both sides are willing enough to make the compromises to get a deal. We know what the compromises are. We know what the deal will look like. What I can't tell you, basically because I'm not a medium, is whether in Boris Johnson's mind, the argument for a deal is stronger than the argument against. And same for President Macron and other European leaders. And it's only if they decide, actually, yes, we desperately want a deal, so we'll make the necessary compromise, that we'll get one.
So from my perspective, Annan, and obviously you know, I suppose for people to look at it from the outside, I kind of sometimes think about like the trade negotiations and in general and Brexit in particular as being a bit like a football game, like when we were kids. Like everyone has to set and follow the agreed upon rules in order for the game to work. And the fundamental problem of Brexit is that Britain kind of wants to follow its own rules and do what it likes. And you can do that, but then it's harder to play any sort of game. And in the end, like the other kids don't want to play with you. And Britain ends up just fundamentally being this kind of sad, lonely kid playing by its own rules, but also fundamentally playing by itself. Do you think that's like a fair characterization of where Britain is at the moment? And specifically, I'm thinking about things like wanting to take back complete control over our own laws. I'm unsure how you can both follow all your own rules and also expect to kind of have a trading relationship with those next to you or expect the other kind of people around you to be happy with that.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'll say is if it's like a football match, it's like sort of George Graham's Arsenal against George Graham's Arsenal, and it's going to be really boring and then 0-0. And it's not a spectator sport, this. But, yes, you're right to a point. But you can have a trade deal that doesn't interfere with your laws. You can have a trade deal that has nothing to do with regulations. You can just say, we're cutting tariffs. That's it. Now, the full-on sovereignty argument makes no sense because agreeing not to impose tariffs is a constraint on your sovereignty. So even a tariff-free deal involves you saying there are things you could do but you won't do, all right? But when it comes to regulations, and that's the real sticking point in these talks, you're right. The majority of costs from Brexit will come not because of tariffs, if we get them, but from the fact that our regulations will be different from the EU's regulations. So things will have to be checked. We won't have the same access to their market because we won't be meeting their standards or meeting their qualifications or whatever. So under the single market, we had aligned our regulations or we'd agreed to accept each other's regulations. If you don't do that, if you don't agree to harmonise your rules, there's a real limit to what you can achieve in a trade negotiation, because actually tariffs overall, with exceptions like a lot of agriculture and food and drink, are very low. So the real prize from trade negotiations is in regulatory agreements, but they involve you saying, we will not do certain things with our law without consulting you or without doing them in tandem with you. So unless you accept the same rules, there are real severe limits as to what you can do. We both fallen asleep.
we're just enthralled by your talking there, Alan. one thing that we were like, I suppose one thing, okay, there's another thing I sometimes think about this, which is also, and Mike, I'd be interested to know your perspective on this, that like Britain seems to have broken its word so many times that the other partners don't trust it. And I don't know how much substantively that makes a difference or whether it's just a case of people have kind of learned to accept that's the way it is. But people are a lot less willing to give us a good deal in the end because they go, well, actually, we really don't trust these guys on the other side. They really are acting in really bad faith.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, we've changed our mind. I mean, we had an election, and you'd think that people in other EU member states would get the fact that if you have an election and you have a new prime minister, that new prime minister might have a completely different set of demands to the old prime minister. And that's not changing your mind. That's changing your government. Okay. And I think that happened. So Boris Johnson came in and basically wants far less from the relationship with the EU than Theresa May wanted. And once he had the election, he said, actually, that stuff I signed up to before the election, I'm not so keen on that anymore because I've won a big victory. Let that pass. The big issue, I think, when it comes to trust is this internal market bill. And there, you know, try as I might, I find it very hard to find any way of excusing the British government to stand up and say we're passing this law which allows us under certain limited circumstances to break commitments we signed up to a year ago is not going to enhance the trust of the other side. And the irony of this is, you know, going back to what we were talking about before, if the sticking points in the talks is partly the fact that the EU wants us to sign up to its rules because they don't trust us, one of the results of the internal market bill is they want us to sign up to their rules even more now because they trust us even less. So actually, in a curious way, you could argue that the internal market bill has made it harder, not easier, to get to an agreement because the EU is less likely to back down because they see what this government is capable of doing.
And shall we chat about fishing quickly and talk about what? Oh, I mean, you guys can't see this, but Anna just put his head in his hands. But I would say that, like, this is okay. One reason I think it's fascinating is because it's it's a preview of what is to come, which is that trade deals tend to, the problem with trade deals tends to be the costs are concentrated, but the benefits diffuse. And so here you have a fishing industry that's worried about their jobs, their livelihoods. They're going to very loudly say, we don't want this kind of deal. And that happens in trade deals the world over. But the benefits of, I don't know, cod that is 2% cheaper for the consumer is a much wider benefit, but much less widely felt. And so this is the kind of fight we could expect in trade deals, like now and going in the future, whatever Britain wants to do with other nations post-Brexit.
Except, let me say two things and then come on to it. Firstly, it's just worth stressing, this is not like any other trade negotiation ever, for two reasons. Firstly, because you don't revert to the status quo ante in the event of failure. And most trade negotiations, you have a trade negotiation, let's say the talks blow up, you end up where you started from, okay? In these trade negotiations, if they blow up, you end up in a very, very different place to where you started from, because you started from membership and you end up on WTO terms. So the status quo ante doesn't hold. So the stakes in these negotiations are far, far higher than they are in normal trade negotiations. Okay. The second thing about this trade negotiation that makes it unique, it's the only trade negotiation I'm aware of in the history of anything that is all about making trade more difficult. Okay, so there are precious few wins from the Brexit talks in purely economic terms, because what we're arguing about is what new constraints to put on our ability to trade with each other. This isn't about freeing up trade, it's about making it harder. Now, in that broader context, when we come to fish, it's not even about the economics. It's not about whether cod is 2% cheaper. And actually, we import most of the cod we eat. It's about whether a political promise to give British fishermen a greater proportion of the catch is going to be honoured. And for a variety of reasons, many of them symbolic, this really matters way, way beyond the economic significance of the sector. I mean, the interesting thing about fisheries is it's an almost perfect case of interdependence. We export the vast majority of the fish we catch, and we import the vast majority of the fish we eat. So if this was a question of the British fishermen are going to catch loads more fish and we won't be able to sell it to the EU, so we should eat it ourselves, then get ready to eat herring a lot, which we don't. Okay? So in a rational economic world, it is a no-brainer. There should be a deal, because otherwise we can't sell our stuff. And we can't import stuff we want to eat as cheaply. But it's not about that. It is about delivering on a political promise. And, you know, it is weird and it is economically irrational. But President Macron is being equally weird and economically irrational, because he's holding out for a deal on fish, because he's got fishermen who are liable to, God knows what, chuck fish on the streets of Paris, blockade the channel. There's an election in Calais next year that he's anxious not to lose. And actually, if you lose the fishermen and if there's disruption, that's a big deal. So this is about politics. It's not about the market. It's not about the fish. I mean, ultimately, this is not a row about the fish. This is a row about the fishermen.
And you said you didn't want to talk about fish.
That was a very passionate.
I've never.
I was just playing nicely.
You were in your zone.
I mean, we can go back to Bielsa if you want. I mean, that's.
So moving on, maybe to the economic and political consequences of Brexit. And Jeevan, you're obviously someone, you're an economist, so you know a great deal about this. Andrography matters.
Is that they'll claim to know to the fifth decimal place. Sorry, Jeevan, that was a bit unkind.
No, it's definitely true, Anand. Like, you know, I'm placed, you know, we've got to be confident in our assertions, you know what I mean? I've got models and they're the right models, so that's the way I like to look at the world.
Oh, gosh.
Mike, did you want me to go through the economic implications of...
Yeah, sure. So I was going to say, geography obviously matters hugely when it comes to trade. And obviously, trade deals with the US, with China, with Indonesia, with Japan, are unlikely to economically make up for trade we're going to lose with the EU. And most reliable forecasts of the economic impact of Brexit have highlighted that it's going to be negative. Jeevan, do you want to elaborate a bit further on this?
Yeah, so that is correct. And like, you know, I'm sure people listening already know that the lower trade integration with the EU leads to lower growth. Like that is the simple trade-off you have. But the reason for that is a really well-supported principle in trade economics, which is you trade more with countries that are closer to you, precisely because they are close to you. Transportation costs are lower. You're culturally more likely to be similar. And at the same time, you're in the you're in literally the same time zone, or you tend to be, with your closest neighbours. And that's why you want a close training relationship with your closest partners. And for the UK, I think about half our trade was with the EU. Now, people might object and say, we're looking for trade and services, and so these trade costs don't matter anymore. But service integration in trade is much harder to achieve than goods trade integration in trade. And the world's most integrated service market is the European Union. Like, India are not going to let you penetrate their market and challenge their IT sector in Bangalore. Like, that's not going to happen. And so, no, a trade deal with Japan or Australia won't have the same benefits as one with the European Union, because they are further away. And the reason that, like, a lot of Brexiteers might not get this is because this is the thing that's taught in, like, trade economics, and not the thing that's taught in, like, microeconomics 101. And as far as Anandor, like, elaborate upon, trade deals aren't made using principles from economic 101. That's really about the bargaining power of each side to get their way. It's not about everyone going, hey, it's now comparative advantage, let's all just cut tariffs. That's not the way the real world works, no matter how nice our economist models sometimes are.
I mean, I love the way that economists claim to have invented geography, that it's an economic insight.
I mean, that was a hard week, Anand. Okay, like, we all put a lot.
But no, it's true. And I don't know about some you know, future where the world relies on 3D printing, for instance. I mean, you could imagine a world where 3D printing transforms the geography of international trade and means that actually we don't trade anymore. We simply sell patents to the village in Nigeria where they print whatever it is you've just sold them the patent for. And so there's no production cost. But I think that world is a long, long way away. For the moment, I mean, we can be honest about this. There is absolutely no way that signing trade deals with all the other countries in the world is going to make up for the loss of trade with the European Union. That simply won't happen, because we trade so much with the European Union. And yes, I mean, what are the arguments? One argument is all the growth is in Asia, so it makes sense to reorient our trade towards Asia. Well, unless we're planning to row there as a country and park ourselves off the coast of Vietnam and be part of Asia, the logic doesn't work. Because, yes, there's a growth market there, but we're not going to make cars with Vietnam the way we make cars with Germany, for obvious reasons, because of shipping, because of hassle, because, you know, you can't have a just-in-time supply chain very easily if you're coming from the other end of the planet by boat, all right? There is more scope for delays. So, yeah, the geography matters. And I think, you know, we've got to the point now where I think some of our colleagues at the LSE did some modelling of this, and I think they came up with a figure of 0.4% of GDP is the projected benefit of a trade deal with the United States where every single tariff is reduced to zero. Okay, so A, we're not going to get a deal where every single tariff is reduced to zero, because even President Biden is more protectionist than former US presidents, because American politicians have been stung by the politics of the last 4 years. And B, even if we got that deal, 0.4 does not compare very well with the 6 to 8% that economists are forecasting as the negative economic impact of the kind of Brexit, even with a deal, that we are talking about now. So the impact, I think, for this government, the interesting thing about trade deals is politics. That's to say, you wave a piece of paper, as Liz Truss was doing recently. We've signed a trade deal with Japan. Now, it turns out that the trade deal we've signed with Japan is pretty much the same as the trade deal we had anyway with Japan as a benefit of our EU membership. So it means we don't lose anything. It doesn't mean we gain anything.
I think that's a good segue into the politics of this, Alan. So I think about Johnsonism. I think it's more of an approach to politics than like a firm ideology or concrete political ideas. It's like positivity in the face of oppression or adversity or crisis. And at times, of course, this optimism is misplaced, or it's coupled with a lack of attention to detail. And the Prime Minister likes to present himself as the arbiter of positivity. So if he manages to get a deal, I imagine the message or story he'll be able to tell is, despite all the naysayers, I've managed to get a trade deal and deliver on my promise. What do we think about the political implications of this? Like, how good would it look for Johnson if he was to manage to get a deal now?
I think this is the strongest reason militating in favour of there being a deal, is that politically it might be better for the Prime Minister to come back saying, see, I've done it against all the odds, and be hailed as a hero. Those who try and say, yeah, but hang on, it's a pretty crap deal, will be shouted down. you won't get any airtime. So basically, the fact of the matter is, you will sell yourself as a hero. I not only delivered on Brexit, I persuaded those evil Europeans to sign a trade deal, even though they didn't want to. That will be the rhetoric. I think you're absolutely right. I would quibble about the idea of Johnsonism. I don't think there is a Johnsonism in the same way that there wasn't really a Mayism. I don't think you can have a political ideology that is simply the temperament of the person in charge. So Johnsonism is, you know, not really caring about detail, using lots of weird metaphors and being generally upbeat. Isn't a political philosophy. It's a character. It's a set of character traits. Maybe Johnsonism will emerge over time. One of the problems about Johnsonism is Johnson is whoever you need him to be. So when Johnson is mayor of London, he's global, he's liberal. When he's running for leader of the Conservative Party, he is hard Brexit, let's cut trade with the European Union. And when he's running the out campaign, it is immigration is bad. So, you know, Johnson is a chameleon as a politician in the sense that he will do and say what it takes at the time. Okay, now, all politicians do that to an extent, but I think it's striking the degree to which he does this. So I'd be reluctant to talk about Johnsonism because it implies that there's something in the way of a coherent body of politics there that just isn't there as far as I can see.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I do take the point about Johnsonism. I sort of think it's more of an approach than a set of ideological principles that he's following. I guess on Johnson as well, like I think it is important he gets a deal because he has presented himself throughout this process as the adult in the room. So in 2019, he campaigns on the idea of I'm the adult in the room, so I'm going to come and solve Brexit and all the quibbling about Brexit and get a deal. And in February, he says that it's very unlikely we're going to leave the EU without a deal. So I think it is politically important he gets a deal. I was going to say, because there's a growing perception he's quite incompetent. So like following the government's mismanagement of the pandemic, and that can be sort of exemplified by the constant U-turns.
Yeah.
I think it would be politically really, really dangerous for Johnson if we did leave the European Union without a deal.
I think it plays into the hands of the Starmer attack line, which is incompetence. I think that's the danger of no deal. I'll come back in a minute to the alternative, which is why there might be a political incentive for going with no deal. I don't think Johnson sold himself as the adult in the room. I think he sold himself as the only person who was tough enough to stand up to the European Union. I mean, the idea was that Theresa May was weak. She caved. She gave in. And I think a lot of what Johnson has done, whether it's prorogation or the internal market bill, has been as much about signalling to his own party that he's not Theresa May and he won't take that sort of nonsense and he will stand up for Britain, as it has been about the substance. It's been projecting an image of Boris Johnson being the bloke who will do what it takes to get this done. And I think that's very important to him, which is why, for instance, I don't think there's any prospect of the government saying, even if they could, which I don't think they could, can we extend transition, please? Because that's not the USP of Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson does what it takes to get it done. Now, why might he have a political interest in no deal? Well, I think that a lot of that comes out of the things that Michael Gove has been saying over the last month. Michael Gove has been making the point, and he made it again yesterday and indeed overnight, in this statement saying businesses need to get ready, that actually a lot of the preparations that businesses need to make for no deal, they need to make for a deal, okay? Which is a polite way of saying that the deal is going to be very thin, okay? Now, that has got some people in the Tory party, I think, thinking, hang on a sec, if you're saying that a deal is going to be really disruptive, we'll own that because, as you said, Boris Johnson will sign a deal, claim credit for it, do a victory lap, say, this is a fantastic deal I signed. All of a sudden in January, you have disruption at the ports. That disruption is at his door. Okay. So the argument goes, if there's going to be disruption with a deal, we might as well have pretty similar disruption with no deal. And at least that way we can blame the EU and none of it sticks on us. So that might be a reason why the government is thinking that no deal would be the better outcome. The other reason is, there are plenty of Tory MPs who are absolute sort of dyed-in-the-wool, hard Brexiters who say no compromise with the European Union. We shouldn't sign up to any of their rules. Their claims on state aids and subsidies, their level playing field stuff, outrageous. Don't sign up to it. And one of the problems that Johnson has is that many of those people are precisely the same people who are agitating most loudly about lockdown. And it might be, for instance, that he thinks, do I want to pick another fight with these people, make them even more angry? I'm not saying that necessarily means that he's going to go down in favour of no deal. All I'm saying is you know, despite what we've said about the impact of no deal, you can still see, if you sort of squint, a case for doing it, which is political.
Yeah, I think just the points on the MPs, actually, I do think there's great irony in the MPs who sort of scoffed at forecasts highlighting the negative economic effects of Brexit are the same MPs who are critical of lockdown because of the economic ramifications of lockdown. I think that there's great irony in that. The points on Starmer you made... The point you made on Starmer is interesting because Starmer has, like, justifiably so, focused on the Prime Minister's lack of competence. And moving forward, I think moving forward for Starmer, kind of a tangential point here maybe, is like he needs to demonstrate why the government's incompetent. So like he's told the story about the government's incompetent. And I think he needs to tell the story of why. And like, is it an ideological set of principles that are guiding the government's decision making? Is it their approach to governance that makes them incompetent? I think that's a story he could tell with Brexit, maybe. Their entire approach to politics is what's leading to their poor decisions and their incompetence. Jim, do you have anything to add in terms of the political consequences of Brexit?
I would say maybe two things from the Trump and the from the Johnson and the Starmer side. From the Johnson side, I think that like Brexit, there's like an analogy to be made with Trump's Mexican wall, which is that there's this big totemic announcement that like wasn't delivered as promised. How did it play out? Well, as long as your supporters can say that you declare victory and they believe you, your electoral prospects look to be reasonably unaffected. Mm-hmm. And so for Johnson, if he can walk away and say this is great and people believe him, who support him, then in one sense, he won't suffer an electoral kind of backlash for it because it's fine. He gets to keep his coalition together. Now, it's also hard, I think, as Anna has said, to kind of sell the counterfactual in one sense. So it's hard to say when growth is just like lower through time, what that means compared to a huge disruption. So if that ends up happening, if the economy ends up being smaller, we don't really notice it. And the same thing happened with austerity between 2010 and 2015. The economy was smaller, but the Tories didn't pay a price for it because actually you couldn't sell the counterfactual. And by the time you come to the next election, the economy is growing anyway. But all that being said is, I don't think that means he does necessarily win the next election. Like we should always remember that Johnson didn't so much win in 2019 as Labour lost. You know, Johnson and the Conservatives went from 42% under May to 43% under Johnson. The thing that changed was Labour went from 40 to 33%. And that's what led to these huge kind of changes in seats. But the actual numbers of votes Johnson get wasn't huge. And so it doesn't take a huge amount to imagine a world in which Johnson is seen as winning the Brexit war. And then people want Starmer to lead the Brexit peace. Like that's a world that looks like a feasible world to me. And the final thing I would say from the Starmer side of it is, I don't think the polling is a great guide anyway as to what to do, but I'm not sure. And I think Mike picking up on the point that you just made about Starmer not setting out an alternative vision, at the moment talking about abstaining on the Brexit bill to me is a mistake. Like you should put your marker down and say why you should and shouldn't want something. And so I'm not quite clear, like what does Starmer do? Does he vote in favour because he thinks it's the right deal, or does he vote in favour because he thinks that it's the foundation for a better deal? I think, like you say, it has to be an alternative vision of government, because at least kind of anecdotally, the thing you hear a lot of people who are not politically engaged is say, yes, Starmer is much better than Corbyn, but also I don't really know what he wants to do. He kind of has the chance to make his case, and now he has to go make it in some way.
I mean, that being said, he's got, you know, 3 years. No opposition party becomes specific this far out of an election because it gives too many hostages to fortune. And of course, we don't know. I mean, I'd say several things. I mean, I tend to agree that Starmer needs to come up with a narrative in the event that there is a Brexit deal, because simply saying no deal would be rubbish sort of lets Johnson off the hook if he signs a very thin deal. I also agree that it is going to be hard to draw that line from Brexit to economic impact. I mean, I think people aren't doing themselves any favours by going on about cliff edges. This isn't a cliff edge. It's more like a slow puncture, okay? And if you're a cyclist, you know, I mean, a slow puncture is a pain. And there are two defining features of a slow puncture, aren't there? Firstly, it takes you a long time to realise you've got one. So you could be cycling for weeks and sort of assume, like I do, that it's your legs getting old and, you know, my God, I'm getting slower every day until you finally see that the tire is flat. And I think that is the Brexit impact, because it will hit us over time. Over the next 5 to 10 years, those companies that have tried to keep trading with the European Union, despite all the new costs and the new paperwork, finally think, you know what, this is too hard. This is too difficult. We're going to have to look for other markets. And it will, you know, so the impact will be slow. The other thing about a slow puncture is that by the time you've noticed it, you've got absolutely no clue where you picked it up. And I think that's the danger with Brexit, is if in 6 years' time we find that we've got very little in the way of manufacturing left because manufacturing has relocated elsewhere within the European single market, in those intervening 6 years, lots of economic things would have happened that to which that decision could be attributed. But I think Labour are missing a trick by not starting with that narrative now. This is a deal. That's great. It's far better than no deal. However, bear in mind, this is a deal that will cost us jobs and growth. And over the next 4 years, we will chart that progress for you so you can see what this government has done to you. Strikes me as a decent starting point for the opposition. But simply sort of letting Johnson off, as it were, and saying, OK, you've got a deal. That's great. Let's move on. Bear in mind, the economic impact of Brexit will, deal or no deal, almost certainly be greater than the economic impact of COVID. So the big economic event of this parliament, and it's hard to process this now because we're mid-COVID and we know that there's a horrible unemployment crisis going to hit us in the spring. But the big economic event of this parliament is not going to be COVID, it's going to be Brexit. The problem is that at the moment, it's quite hard to see that. But I do think a responsible opposition would start drawing up attack lines in anticipation of that.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, the slow puncture point in particular, because I was just thinking that a lot of Johnson's electoral coalition, you know, you think of them being whole older homeowners who are wealthier, probably have more, are just economically more prosperous, that actually they're going to be much more protected from any kind of the costs of Brexit. And Starmer needs to start thinking about which of the people he's going to end up peeling off to get them back. And I suspect it would be those ones who see some kind of income loss from Brexit, and he needs to make that connection between the two. You know, if you're at the end and you're Starmer and you're saying, okay, I need to get Johnson down to, let's say, 35, I need to figure out where I'm getting those votes from. I don't think you're going to get them from pensioners or rich homeowners in the southeast who it doesn't really make any difference to them. It's actually going to be from those who feel that loss, and you have to start making that case now and figure out a way to make
it affects people indirectly, doesn't it? I mean, the holy grail here is economic competence. Is the ambition of the Labour Party should be the party that is seen as more economically competent by the time we get to the next election. And remember, that's an uphill struggle. Tony Blair wasn't ahead on economic competence in 1997. So, you know, Labour historically has a problem with this. The, you know, 5 years of Jeremy Corbyn aren't going to have helped when it comes to reasserting a reputation for economic competence. But it might be that the Boris Johnson government is the biggest ally they have. But this is all part of the picture, isn't it? Whether it's coronavirus, whether it's Brexit, if you want to be a successful opposition, you start saying, actually, you know what? This has been badly mismanaged. It has cost the economy money. It has cost us jobs. However expensive your house is, however nice your leafy shire is, you don't want to live in a country with millions unemployed, because it will have spillover effects on you, maybe in terms of welfare spending and hence taxation, or it just makes the country a less happy place overall. You know, wealthy people don't like seeing homeless people. I mean, so it's not, you know, I think you can convince even those people, I think, that actually this isn't the way to run a successful economy.
I suppose for me, the analogy would be austerity, where austerity hit those who are of lower incomes. Yeah. And so even though we saw a worse country, Cameron ended up gaining votes because the people it affected weren't his voters at the end of it. Even if they didn't like homelessness, they couldn't see a personal impact, so didn't see the kind of impact of austerity until it's post-2015. And then it's, hold a second, actually, like, my potholes are really bad, the schools are rubbish. And like you say, homelessness is really terrible.
But I'd slightly differently and say that one of the reasons why Cameron got away with austerity is that by 2015, loads of the electorate were still holding Labour responsible for the economic state of the country because of 2008. The British Election Study poll survey work shows this very clearly, that Labour still had not recovered from the hit to its reputation it took because of the financial crisis, rightly or wrongly. I mean, you know, there is an argument this was a global crisis, and actually it wasn't Labour's fault. But the Tories were still able to go back to that. And it's like, well, you know, the economy might not be great, but look what they did. And that was still quite a powerful weapon for the Tories in 2015, I think. And that's different this time around. They've been in power for 14 years.
I suppose my reading would be that in 2015, the economy was growing. And so if it was in 2013, the Tories would have lost the election. And so then the economic competence thing only comes to the fore if you haven't recovered in time by the next time. And then if the impacts are only felt upon your electoral coalition, I think is kind of where I would end up at.
Yeah. No, I think that definitely matters. There's no doubt about that.
I guess just to conclude on the political implications, maybe it'd be nice to talk about maybe geographical divides in the UK. Mm-hmm. And one thing Brexit has done is brought to the fore some geographical divides in the UK. Mm-hmm. Now, Johnson's government have actually spoken about levelling up, so that the idea that they're going to tackle the geographic disparities that have been brought to the fore by the Brexit vote. But the type of Brexit that they're going to advocate for pursuing will exacerbate these geographical divisions. And obviously, we have seen growing support for Scottish independence following the Brexit vote. And I think UK and the Changes Europe did an event on this yesterday. And do you have any thoughts on the geographical divides that have been brought to the fore by the Brexit votes and Johnson's levelling up agenda?
Well, I mean, my first thought on geography is shame on us, in the sense that these things existed before the referendum of 2016. We should have been aware of them beforehand. We should have been aware of the appalling statistics just in terms of health or life expectancy in different parts of the country. It was there for all of us to see, and it shouldn't have needed a referendum for us to suddenly think, oh wow, why did all those people vote against the status quo? Oh, it's because they're not doing as well. Blimey, what a night. So we should have, you know, the referendum alerted us to stuff we really should have been talking about before, first and foremost. Secondly, I mean, one of the phenomenon here, and one of the very, very effective lines used by the Leave campaign was, this is a vote that really counts. Because one of the problems beforehand, of course, is that these people lived in safe seats where it didn't matter who they voted for, because A, we knew who was going to win, and B, if the other party won, both parties' economic policies were pretty close to each other anyway. No one was holding out any hope for these places. So there's a genuine sort of politics of anger, of being fed up, floating around all of this. Now, yes, you're right. Brexit will almost certainly hit the less well-off parts of the country most strongly, because actually the two parts of the United Kingdom least dependent on trade with the European Union, ironically enough, are London and Scotland, which are the two parts of Great Britain, certainly, that voted most strongly to remain. So it's leave areas that tend to be most exposed to the economic impacts of leaving the European Union. It's worth saying, too, that the early evidence suggests that COVID will disproportionately hit those areas as well. So there's a double whammy. You start off behind, you have COVID, then you have a Brexit impact. So levelling up will get much, much more difficult because of both those things. Now, I don't think personally that when the Prime Minister talks about levelling up, he means dealing with the structural economic inequalities that scar this country in terms of outcomes, in terms of education levels, in terms of GVA value added. But I think he means actually showing these places a bit of love, a bit of concern, talking about them a bit more, setting up building and infrastructure projects there. Now, we can scoff very easily and say, yeah, but that doesn't get rid of the structural issues. No, but actually you're talking about places that feel like they've been ignored by politics since the 1980s when their industries were closed down. You know, it's the place where I come from, Wakefield, where there were mines shut down, Wakefield's economy, that was it. It was, you know, it's been 40 very, very difficult years since. So actually to get a government in Westminster that is actually talking about you, that is saying you are our priority, makes a big difference by itself. So my suspicion is that whilst the big structural problem will take decades to fix, because they took decades to create, doing enough to persuade some of those red wall voters that you're trying, and actually, unlike any government in living memory, you are making sure that they know that you're one of their priorities, might be enough. I don't know.
I think that's a fair point. I think the performance in politics, the performance in politics is as important as the substance. Mm-hmm. So I say it with Trump as well. Like Trump, the performance of his politics was equally as important as the actual substance and the outcomes. For his base, it was the idea that he was fighting for them, he was placing their issues on the agenda. And I think the same for you could say the same for these maybe people who feel overlooked by politics in the UK. They obviously Boris Johnson is maybe with his levelling up agenda, it's the idea that he's at least speaking about us, at least he cares about us, unlike politicians in the past.
That's the key thing. On our side is the key phrase.
Yeah.
Here's someone who's on our side.
Yeah, I would agree with that. If you can have a value appeal that overcomes your kind of economic appeal, then you will end up winning those votes. And I think you see the same thing, like you say, with Trump in the United States. You will see the same thing with the evangelical community as well, where it's like the stance on abortion overcomes and overrides everything else. And so here, I think the same thing is true. On the actual substance, I think you're right. It's not a huge amount of change. I think there are two things in particular that point to that. One of which is Johnson isn't in favor of devolution, and you don't get to deal with the economic inequality in this country without dealing with the political centralization that we have. And the second point is also High Speed 2. Like High Speed 2, all it ends up doing is, aside from the arguments about capacity on that particular rail line, is it makes people come to London more quickly. It enlarges the effective area of London. If you really want to fix the levelling up challenge, the thing you actually end up doing is you say, okay, let's figure out why do so many passengers want to come to London and instead make sure they're not. So maybe you rebuild the Golden Triangle between Leeds, Manchester and Liverpool, or you ensure other places are more connected with themselves rather than just coming in faster to London.
I disagree slightly on HS2, I have to say. I mean, I think HS2 was badly marketed and badly managed in the sense that I wouldn't have called it HS2. I'd have called it More Capacity 2 or something like that. Because ultimately HS2, yes, it has one implication is you can get to London 10 or 15 minutes faster from Birmingham or whatever it might be. But actually, that's not the point. The point about HS2 is you free up capacity to get the trains going again all over the country. Because at the moment, one of the problems you have, the further north you go, is that a lot of trains get, you know, high-speed trains get stuck behind local trains because there simply isn't the infrastructure. And HS2 is about providing more infrastructure, freeing up more track that will improve train services. The headline, we have a train that goes to London really fast, fine. But actually, the more important subtext is, and as a result, the other train services that link different parts of the country will be far more effective, far more on time and far quicker because those high-speed things will no longer be cluttering up their tracks. Now, when I say I would have done it differently, I mean, I would have started HS2 not by digging a massive hole behind Euston, but by digging a hole in York. I mean, that strikes me as a no-brainer. If you want to symbolise the fact that this is about capacity outside London, well, start digging your hole outside London, you know, and get the press there and say, this is what we're doing for the country. But I do think, despite how badly marketed and managed it's been, that HS2 will be a good thing for much of the rest of the country, and that the focus on that speed to get to London is slightly misleading.
I take that point. The thing I would say is that this government also counts electrification of rail lines across the country, and there are still trains that go like 30 miles an hour between these different areas. Mm-hmm. And the issue there isn't that they're on the track from London to elsewhere, it's that the connections between them are so bad. And yeah, like, there is an argument for HS2 by itself. I take that. I think the other side of it, though, is that if you actually really cared about that regional equality issue, then like you would look at those other problems, at least in tandem, if not first.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are loads of things. Yeah. I mean, you know, just thinking about this, I mean, the sheer scale of the regional inequality in this country is just amazing. It's eye-watering. You know, doing big infrastructure projects is what this prime minister likes, but there's far, far more from that. As you correctly said, I think an element of devolution and allowing people who understand their regions and the problems they face to make some of the decisions and spend some of the money would be good. This government has been a very, very centralizing government to date, and there's no sign of that changing. And, you know, we touched on Scotland. I'm suspicious about whether or not the idea that lots of presents from London that come in boxes wrapped in the Union flag are what it's going to take to persuade the Scots not to support the SNP. I mean, the first step is supporting the SNP in May next year in the Scottish election. But I don't think a London-based strategy of just how good are we to you, you know, how good is London being to you, little Scottish people, is not the strategy I would adopt for this.
Right. Do we have any concluding thoughts on the political outcomes here, maybe?
Who knows? I mean, I think one of the amazing things about where we are is when we get to spring next year and we have this unemployment crisis, the whole political debate is going to be different. I think we underestimate at our peril the degree to which March, April, May are going to be a fundamentally different world to the one we're in now.
Yeah, I have one about, I suppose, more about Britain's place in the world, which is that we seem to have this problem of of declining empires all the way around, of these kind of bizarre delusions of grandeur. We haven't really adjusted to the way the world is. We prefer the fantasies of yesteryear. Like terms like global Britain and buccaneering, swashbuckling spirits are reflective of a nation that's more comfortable with its past than the future and is not confident about the future. I mean, sometimes the disconnect reminds me of kind of Byzantine emperors like talking about being the emperor of Rome, despite not having set foot there for 1,000 years in Constantinople, 900 miles away. It's just not at all accordant with reality. It's like, guys, look around, the world has changed, and what you're describing isn't the real world. And it doesn't matter how many times you say it, if you believe it strongly, that doesn't change that. And Britain's place in the world is completely adrift because we don't have really a conception of where we are.
I mean, there's an element of truth to that. And I think there are those who let nostalgia get in the way of analysis and who haven't recognized the reality of relative decline. That's absolutely the case. That being said, you know, if you talk to even our biggest detractors on the global diplomatic scene, they will accept the fact that British diplomacy over the last few months around COP26 and using diplomacy to persuade other countries to sign up to more ambitious climate targets has been very impressive. And also bear in mind, over the next 12 months, the UK will have the presidency of the G7, it'll chair the United Nations Security Council, and we are hosting the COP26 summit. So if ever there was a year when actually global Britain might actually have some reality to it, despite the fact that we're no longer as powerful as we used to be and no longer as powerful as some people think we still are. I think it's important not to go from one extreme to the other. In other words, I think for a country of this size, this country wields a significant amount of influence still, but we don't run the world and people aren't going to stand to attention when we walk into a room in the way that maybe they used to do. But that doesn't mean that we're not without our influence. And this is a spectacularly important year in the history of British foreign policy that is coming up.
I think those are both fair points. So like, just to add to Jeevan's point, I think Brexit should be understood as indicative of Britain's struggle to conceive its place in the world post-empire. Like, during the Leave campaign, we see this yearning for a supposedly glorious past. You have a notion that once free from the shackles of the EU, Britain can become a global superpower. But I do also take the point that Britain is still hugely influential in global affairs. Like, it would be ignorant to suggest that Britain is not an influential country as it stands in foreign affairs. But there is still this yearning for empire. And an additional point on the yearning for empire and nostalgia for empire is it wasn't exclusive to the Leave side. Like, mainly on the Remain side had this idea that rather than leave the EU, Britain should lead the EU and be the dominant force in the EU because it deserved to be the dominant force in the EU because it's Britain. So I guess for me, like, one thing I always say, and I think Jeevan's sort of with me on this, is the idea that Britain needs to actually contend with its history and understand its history to understand the problems and divisions that exist today. And I think Brexit's indicative of that.
Yeah, though, a couple of interesting things. I mean, to an extent, Britain was one of the certainly most influential member states of the European Union, but that's history now. I think, let's figure out how to put this. I think it is undoubtedly the case that there is this sort of imperial nostalgia amongst some. One of the interesting things about the Leave coalition that led to Brexit is that for some people, Brexit was about pulling up the drawbridge. It was about too many foreigners here, too many Chinese imports, and we've lost our jobs. It was about insulating us from the outside world. And yet for another bunch of Brexiters, the ones who happen to be in government now, this was about global Britain. This was about becoming a free trading, swashbuckling, globally oriented, you know, the foreign secretary can't open his mouth without saying Indo-Pacific tilt. I don't think that's necessarily what the Leave voters in Labour constituencies were after when they voted Leave, that all of a sudden we would become a presence in the, you know, South China Sea or whatever. So I think there were different views of Britain's place in the world. In general, the survey evidence, I think, certainly the stuff we've done, indicates that Leavers place more of a priority on sorting things out at home than on making our presence friends in the world. They tend to be more insular than Remainers. But nevertheless, we have a Leave government that is being very global in its tone, which is a curious paradox, to say the least.
So you know the survey data better than I would, but is there necessarily an inconsistency between the two? So on the one hand, the idea is you are a powerful nation on the global stage that is also able to protect your citizens at home, and you are powerful precisely because you're freed from the shackles of Europe and the freedom of movement.
I mean, I see what you mean, but that's not the questions were, you know, we need to spend less time worrying about the outside world and more time worrying about ourselves. And Leave voters tend to disproportionately support, for instance, cutting foreign development assistance and things like that. So it's more about, you know, it's a £350 million to the NHS rather than sending it abroad kind of argument, which is we should be focusing our attention and our resources on us. That's not necessarily where the government's going, but we shall see.
Do we have any concluding thoughts about the podcast in terms of what we've covered today?
It's been fun.
Oh, I'd agree with that.
Starving.
Right, before you head off, Anand, it's time for Jam of the Week. So what is your Jam of the Week?
Well, this is really sad, but I've sort of rediscovered in the last week the first album I ever bought, which neither of you will have heard of, but it's by Meatloaf and it's called Bat Out of Hell. And I've been listening to the title track sort of obsessively, simply because it was, as I said, the first album I ever bought. And I just think it's fantastic. You can get your psychologist onto this. There is no deep metaphysical meaning to this. It is simply the fact that I saw the record and thought, blimey, I haven't listened to that for about 30 years, and I've been listening to it obsessively ever since.
Well, fair enough. Would you do anything for love, Anand?
Different album.
Is it? I thought Meatloaf had like one song and that was it, but okay, clearly.
You've exposed your youth.
Oh, that's okay. Well, if you ever want to do a rendition, do feel free.
Oh,
like, we're...
God, no. I'd never sing a song.
We welcome that on this podcast.
Yeah, but I would never sing a song I liked. I think it would be unfair on it.
Fantastic. Anand, thank you so much for joining us today. We've absolutely enjoyed speaking to you about Brexit, and all the best.
Yeah, and to you too. Keep safe in lockdown. I hope we can meet and have a beer in person at some point.
Let's do it. See ya.
All the best.